everyone, this is Catherine O'Connell and welcome to Lawyer On Air. If you are looking for inspirational stories about women in law, then this is the podcast for you. Join me and my lawyer ladies as we enjoy a glass of wine after a hard day at work and talk about the world of women in law. I hope you will enjoy getting to know these amazing women who I am so proud to share a profession with. I'm glad you're here and I hope you enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to this special episode of Lawyer On Air. I'm the host of the show, Catherine O'Connell. Well, we've had a sparkling array of women lawyer guests in season 1, 2, and 3 so far, and I really hope that you are enjoying the wisdom woven through those stories that my guests have been telling you. Women lawyers are my natural audience for the podcast, though in fact, many of my biggest followers and the people who engage with the podcast episodes are people who identify as men. 48% of listeners to this podcast are men. So this has been a real surprise for me, and I'm really thrilled that the voices you hear on Lawyer On Air are reaching the ears of male allies and male champions. While I couldn't really have asked for anything more than impact to go beyond what I envisioned for this podcast, and so now it's really clear to me that it's not only a podcast just for women. It's not a podcast just for women lawyers. It's clear to me that it's very much a draw card for male listeners as well. So this got me thinking about adding some more diversity, equity, and inclusion and inviting a sprinkling of male special guests onto the show. It's important that we do hear from these male champions and male allies in the legal community. And so today I have asked onto the show a managing partner of a large law firm in Tokyo, a firm that, well, unplanned by myself, has turned out to be the employer and past employer of several of the women guests you've heard on the show so far. So listeners, today I'm really pleased to be joined by Matthias Voss, who is the managing partner of Tokyo and Seoul offices of Allen & Overy. Matthias's practice covers the whole range of energy, natural resources, and infrastructure work. He's got 20 years experience advising Japanese, Korean, Chinese, and other international sponsors and financiers on their investments and commercial and finance arrangements. He is consistently recognized as an expert in his field. He's ranked by chambers in Band 1 in Japan for projects in energy, Band 1 in Korea for projects in infrastructure, and named as a leading individual by Legal 500 Asia Pacific for banking and finance in Japan, and that's across all the international firms. Matthias also heads A&O's Global Hydrogen Interest Group, which is an internal focus group bringing together know-how across different practices and offices from around A&O's global network. And by that way, he's connecting over 200 lawyers from more than 30 offices. Energy transition is an area that Matthias tells me he's got a particular passion about, and he dedicates a significant amount of his time in the firm with these kinds of initiatives to help share insights on energy transition to clients and at industry events, and in authoring several thought leadership pieces on the commercial and legal impact of various energy transition developments on business. Matthias has been with Allen & Overy all his working life as a lawyer, joining them as an associate in 1997. Matthias has been in Japan for over 9 years and managing partner in Tokyo for just on 5 years. Prior to coming to Japan in 2013, he was the managing partner of A&O's Beijing office, where he built out the China energy practice, and also having worked in their offices in Shanghai, London, and Paris. He's also worked... No, you haven't.
I might have, you never know.
This is what happens. He also leads the team in Tokyo, Seoul, and Matthias speaks English, Mandarin, French, German, and some Japanese. And I just know recently that he loves music, mostly classical, R&B, and jazz. And he's confessed to me that he's a total chocolate addict. Ah, yes, we are chocolate kindred spirits. So let's get into it. I'm really, really pleased to bring you Matthias as my special guest today. Matthias, welcome to the show.
Catherine, thank you so much for having me. I feel particularly honored also because it's very rare that a middle-aged white male is invited on a show for diversity reasons. So I think that's That's a first for me. But as you said, I think you've already had some perspectives from some of our female talent in the office over the past podcasts. And I'm very pleased to be here today, sort of to maybe add a bit of a white male perspective on the whole thing.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. And it is really quite ironic, isn't it, that that is the diversity factor we're bringing today, but it's very important. And the very first important question I want to ask you is the question I ask all of my women lawyer guests. And that is, if we were meeting up in person, as we actually did by coincidence the other day when we met each other in the supermarket, but this time, if we were going out after work, where would we go? A favorite wine bar or restaurant or cafe that you like to go to? And what would you choose from the menu?
I think that's almost a bit of a sad story. If you'd asked me the same question about a year ago, it would have been very easy. I would have said Helmsdale, which is a nice little whiskey bar on Nisekidori. Unfortunately, Helmsdale, despite its long history, did not survive the COVID crisis.
Oh.
So that's no longer there. But a nice single malt whiskey, I think, would have helped with the conversation, no doubt. But I do like my wine as well, as those who know me know quite well. So I think these days, maybe I would suggest a place called Bunon, which is a slightly eclectic Japanese restaurant near Nishiazabu Crossing. It combines Japanese food and traditional Japanese architecture and setting with a fairly interesting sort of modern French wine selection. Ooh. Or possibly sort of if we go for more traditional French red wines, which I think is where I tend to lean, there is also the Cellar Grill on Aoyamadori. So plenty of choice in Tokyo.
Very nice. Bunon. Now, okay, you just said Nishiazabu Crossing. So that is very close to me. And I've lived here a little while and I still don't know that place. So I really would love to meet up with you there soon because I don't know where it is.
No, absolutely. I'm very happy to introduce you.
That would be fun. Wow. I mean, goodness, you've been in Tokyo market for a long, long time. What brought you here, Mateus? What was the reason you came to Tokyo? And why... Why have you stayed here?
This could be a very long story potentially, but this is not my first time in Japan, but it's probably worth going back a little bit further. I never actually really planned on being a lawyer, which is full and frank disclosure, not what I told Eleanor Nuri when I interviewed with him. But the reality is I did my undergraduate studies in Chinese Sinology, which in those days and in Germany where I did that included a fair element of Japanese studies as well. I then spent a few years living and working in Taiwan as part of my postgraduate studies. But the introduction to law and the real introduction to Japan actually came through a very close Japanese friend who I met during my postgraduate studies in the UK. And as a result of that, just to keep it reasonably brief, I had the opportunity to spend 1 year as a kinkyuin, as a research fellow at the University of Tokyo, at the Faculty of Law, doing research into sociology of law back in 94-95. So that was a very interesting time. I also visited the Tokyo office in those days, Allen & Overy Tokyo office, which was a very different operation from what it is now. But maybe we can come back to that. I then joined Allen & Overy in earnest in London and spent time, as you've mentioned, in Paris, Shanghai, Beijing, partly on the back of my Chinese background, spent 10 years in mainland China before the opportunity arose in 2013, finally to come back to Japan. It may be worth just mentioning sort of to close this off is I think one of the reasons why I did go into law was really that firms like Allen & Overy and the range of international offices and the ability to move between these offices and experience different countries was for me really one of the major attractions of going into law in the first place.
That's interesting, isn't it? That you can stay with a firm but move around different countries and it almost feels like you're doing a completely different practice or having different experiences. That's actually very worthy to say. And so what is it that has changed in the Tokyo market and in the practice? You mentioned a little bit there. What's developed and matured over the years or changed according to your experience?
Well, I think going back to my first experience in the early and mid-1990s, Japan has become much more international and global-minded. That's the ease in which foreigners can operate here. I think it's the business and the way in which business is conducted. So I think Japan actually has come a long, long way, as you would imagine, of a country that's the third biggest economy in the world and hosting some of the most active players globally. So I think from my perspective, what has changed is that I think law firms like us, we used to have a small office in Jinbocho on top of a bookshop. Now we obviously have a much wider and much more varied offering and operation here in Tokyo. And that really reflects also how Japan has changed. It reflects the massive flow of outbound investments that's going from Japan into the rest of the world, and in many cases into jurisdictions where we have offices, where we therefore also have plenty of opportunities and synergies. I mean, a good example here is the US, for instance, where I believe Japan is probably year on year one of the largest, if not the largest, FDI investors. And it's a huge development area for us. We've been building up our US practice over the last few years, as you might have seen. We've just opened our fifth office there. So Japan is just a fantastic place for lawyers like me and others just to connect Japan and Japanese clients with the rest of the world and the network.
Tell me more about that. Why is it really great for lawyers to come to Tokyo and work here? What is it about the Tokyo market? Is it those particular deals that they can have access to? Is there something more going on there?
There's a number of factors, really, and I think everybody will have their own reasons. We, in the Tokyo office, we have a pool of lawyers who are here long-term. And then I think, like most international firms, we tend to have a bit of a roster of people from other offices coming for anything between 6 months and 2 years, maybe just to spend some time in Tokyo, build the connections, have some experience. The reality is that a lot of these people never want to go back. So actually, the second category of lawyers really adds to the first one over time. And you have a lot of people in our office who've been in Japan almost forever. I think I've been here for 9 years, and I'm probably one of the recent arrivals in many ways. And what's keeping people here, I think, really is a number of things. It's the quality of work. There's, I think, some of the highest profile transactions in the world across different practice groups and areas are involved Japanese clients, have strong Japanese connections. You've already mentioned, from my perspective, also energy transition, decarbonization is something that's really changing the world at the moment. Everywhere in Japan, due to its peculiar energy security situation, is very, very heavily affected by this. So there is a natural fit, I think, for people who are interested in this to try and work closely with Japanese clients to find the solutions and to find ways forward. But there's also, from my perspective, and that's just personally, I think one thing I love about Japan, that this is a country that respects lawyers. And actually, Japanese clients are very considerate in their dealings with lawyers, which is not a universal truth or given fact across the globe.
Well, thank you for saying that. That is just so true. I'd thought about that in different ways, but in fact, it is true. And a lot of people ask me, you know, what is it like in Japan as a woman lawyer? Are you subjected to bringing the tea to the meeting rooms and have to do those kinds of jobs? And I said, and I do say to people, no, that's never happened to me. People have respected the legal qualification I have and have never treated me in that way. And so I'm really glad you called that out, because Japan does respect lawyers. And I think we need a little bit more of that in this universe. Thank you for that. That's really amazing. I think as a managing partner, you must be looking at doing all of the hiring or helping the HR team hiring attorneys, male and female. For example, what stands out for you, Matthias, when you're looking at a CV or looking at a person and trying to see them as a fit for this office, knowing that they're probably not going to go back to another country, they want to stay in Tokyo? What's your long-term view on people when you're hiring them?
It's definitely a long-term view, and I think that's not just in the Tokyo office. I think we, in all the offices that I've ever worked in, I think the view was always that recruitment was done with a view to finding the talent that we thought would make it all the way to partnership, potentially. Not everybody has to, but I think that there is a much more long-term vision. We're not looking for worker bees. I think we're looking for genuine team members, and I can add a bit more color on that sort of as we discuss, but what am I looking out for? I think the starting point is when receiving CVs in an office like Tokyo. I think it's a bit easier than, say, in the much larger offices like London or New York. obviously CVs come into HR, but they also come directly to the lawyers. So I think the lawyers probably get much more involved in just looking at all CVs that are coming in than they would do in the mainstream offices, which means that maybe, and I think you've discussed that with some of our star talent on the previous podcast, one of the challenges is always to get through the initial HR vetting process to just have your CV considered in the first place. We can be relatively flexible and look at things and look what people bring to the table. One thing I look for, and that's the CV, and it's also the way in which the CV is being sent, is actually that the CV should be focused and it should have some level of recognition of what we do. You'd be surprised, or maybe not, you may have the same thing, the number of applications that come through that are just a standard CV with a standard cover mail that is being sent. That for me is a very bad starting point, because right, our candidates have choices, but so do we. So I think also in interviews, I look for candidates who've done their homework, who know what we're doing and who tailor their approach to that.
Yes, that's so good. No cookie cutter approach, right? We all know that people want to get a role very quickly, but you know, not being attentive to who they want to spend their working life with, most of their living day with, you know, it really is important that they're doing that research and getting things right. It's like looking for a marriage partner, isn't it? You don't just go in there with the same approach to everybody. It's critical. You mentioned there about staying with the firm and long term. Why is that kind of experience really good to see and to develop within the firm compared to people who may have maybe gone to different law offices and think that's a great idea to have different experiences in different firms? Sticking with the one and only thing that you know, the one same firm, why is that really important and good for the business and good for lawyers for their careers?
I would probably be a bit less dogmatic. I think there are different reasons why people might move. I agree with one of your previous interviews who said it shouldn't be about the money in the short run. And I fully agree with this, because firms like Allen & Overy are, and there's no denying it, they're high performance cultures. So you work very hard, but at the same time also, I think there's, for me, a very important side as to I want to like the people I work with. I want to like the culture. I want to feel that I actually want to stay and work here. And that's, for me, that's one of the reasons why I've been with A&O for all these years. It's not for want of alternatives, but I've always been very privileged and very lucky to work with people who genuinely care, who have a real team and collaborative spirit, and who pull together in a way that actually makes it fun being in the office, even when the hours sometimes are longer. From my perspective, there is, and everybody looks at this differently, I think I look at every CV afresh. So people may have had good reasons for moving around, and that often might make sense and may actually also be right for us in terms of background. What I really look for in people is a sense of curiosity. It's an open-mindedness and flexibility, because we live in a fast-changing world. And I really look for people who are willing to adapt, who are willing to listen, who are willing to change. And that's important for the team. And it's also important for client connections.
Those are really, really important points. And you've just said nothing to do with how good they are as a lawyer. You've said nothing about what their grades are. You're talking about so-called soft skills, which I think are very hardwired skills, actually. Team and collaborative spirit, curiosity, open-mindedness, willing to adapt, willing to listen. How do you find those when you're talking with people? Is it the way you're asking questions to them? Are you finding out how they've behaved in previous situations? How do you find that they're going to be somebody who has that team collective spirit and those assets you were just talking about?
I think everybody has their own approach, but I think the personal interviews are actually more important than the CV. I wouldn't totally underestimate and deny that we also look at grades and academic qualifications and track record generally. I think that's a given in some ways, although I would like to emphasize, as somebody who hasn't gone through the typical top UK universities or Ivy League universities in the US, it's not about that. I think it's more giving a good impression of people's quality of thinking and of their just also of their enthusiasm for what they're doing. So it's not linked to particular institutions. But I think the way that we look at people, we're very closely knit team. So whenever we interview, it's never was a single interview. I think it will be interviews in batches, which can be very painful for candidates. But one of the things that we're really looking for is that whoever is the candidate fits well in with the existing team, and that you can only do that if you have actually people at different levels of seniority interviewing the candidates in question.
Good. And would that also include people who are maybe 1 or 2 years in, sort of fresh into the
Absolutely,
firm?
Yes.
Oh, that's very interesting, because normally it's, you know, it's around, not normally, that's my bias there. But in my experience, it has been senior people within the firm and perhaps people from other practice groups, but not really anybody who's a little less experienced or is more junior in the practice. So I think that's actually quite a fascinating way to approach.
And it depends a bit on who you interview. So I suspect we wouldn't have a second year associate interviewing a lateral partner candidate. But I think we do tend to have interviews matching at the equivalent level of the person who may or may not join us, because they will need to work together. So I think there's a generational aspect. There is different cultural backgrounds. I think you can never have a much information on views on these things.
Before we talk today, I know we talked previously about, you mentioned people were, you know, you liked that they were different, but not too exotic. And you sort of mentioned building that personal rapport with them. But is there something more on that being different, but not too different aspect that you would like to talk about?
I think there are a few aspects to that. One is, and it's something that I've encountered here more than anywhere else, that there is a general perception that saying, oh yes, A&O is a UK law firm, which in some ways is true in the sense that our biggest office is in London. In other ways, it's probably less true in the sense that in this office we have, and it's a relatively small office, of course, but we have at present 13 nationalities represented with over 11 languages being spoken. If you go back about 18 months, we probably had about 19 or 20 nationalities here. And the interesting thing is, I don't think, I can't say for sure, but I don't think we actually have a single Brit in the office amongst the lawyers. So we are an incredibly diverse group of people here,
right,
in all senses of the word. And to me, that's quite important. I think it's a little bit like putting together a football team. You don't want all people playing the same position. That would be a disaster. You need different people who complement each other, who inspire each other, and who can do the same thing with clients. Now, the aspect that we spoke about the other day about, I think what I was thinking about is more, there's sometimes these days, both in education, but also in hiring, can be a tendency to look for clones.
What does that mean?
In a sense that people are coached to have particular things on their CV, to say the same things in interviews. You have people who sort of are being driven to go and all study the same subjects, do the same extracurricular activities, show leadership qualities, and so on. And I think all of this is important, but I think what I'm looking for, and I think that's part of also why our team works well, we want real people, people who have a life out of the office, who have passions, who have interests, who don't always talk about law. I remember we had a recent interview where we asked, and this is a warning to anybody who ever interviews, there will always be a question from me saying, who are you when you're not in the office? What do you do?
Right.
What sort of excites you? And somebody says, I love reading law reports. Ooh. Now that may have been the case, but I think that's not necessarily, I think, the best answer. And I generally expect that probably wasn't true either.
Maybe it was bedtime reading, so they fell asleep. I'm not sure, but that's very interesting. It's almost like saying the answer that they think you want to hear, but actually you want to hear that they really like spending time with their family, or they really like getting together with their friends, or they like participating with some, you know, people they haven't seen for a while at one of the Chamber of Commerce events, or, you know, they just like doing knitting and creating scarves for their friends or something.
No, right, and we have in the office, we have everything from people who love cooking to people who run marathons in their spare times, or even ultra marathons. I think it's the variety that makes it interesting.
For sure. And I mean, that leads me really nicely into the aspects that my previous guests, your employees have talked about, which was about the DEI initiatives. You know, the fact that you've got this brilliant work policy or paternity leave policy. And those are matters they've talked about a lot without any prompting from me. They've come out with this. And I think it's a really important point about the office that you have here, and that you bring this a little bit of a different way to approach the way that you treat and look after your staff. Tell us more about those policies that you have in place and why that matters to you, that you've got something different that looks after people in their lives as well as their careers in law.
Absolutely. And I know you've had a number of our female star lawyers on previous sessions. I think the reality is, and I may be too honest here, but I think policies keep evolving because we all learn as we go along. So we tend to try and have market-leading policies, not necessarily because we think it's a PR tool, but I think it's also very important. The world is changing, and we have to accommodate people of all backgrounds and give equal chances to people to succeed. So the policies are obviously a very important aspect of this. And we can come back to paternity, which is something that I have had fairly strong views on. The reality is, though, and I think Shir sort of described this in a very nice way, once you have the policy, you then actually also need to test whether it works. And we're lucky in a sense that we are maybe a slightly smaller office and therefore can be much more flexible than I think maybe some of the bigger offices can be. But the process for me has always been over the last few years actually to take all these policies, to test them, and to sit down with the people who will benefit from these policies or suffer, as the case may be, and actually sit down together with them and work through what we can do better, how we can adapt. Because also a policy that works somewhere in the UK doesn't necessarily work in the Middle East or in Japan, or not in the same way. So I think Shir has given a very good example that we actually sat down with her, and she was very instrumental in helping us rewrite our maternity policy and actually working out, which is more important than the policy, is trying to find ways how you make this work in practice, because the policy is really just a starting point.
Yes, you're talking about Shir Wang, who was one of our guests, and she was really the one that inspired me to want to speak with you, Matthias, because of this policy. Do tell me more then about that paternity, because it's a passion of yours, I can very well tell. And also, you know, the situation in Japan is that not many men take paternity leave, and I think you changed things up on that.
Let's say we have started changing on it, so we have improved the paternity policy. I think from my perspective as a firm and also as an office, we can probably do more, and I think we should do more. Because over all these years, I think one of the things that at least has become obvious to me is that it's systemic issues that are holding female talent back. And the systemic issues cannot be resolved just by focusing on the women. And I think that's actually, in some ways, sometimes it's a bit lazy sort of, and it also shifts the responsibility from men to women. And a good example, people with the best intentions of the world sometimes will ask women who come back from maternity leave, so sort of, what do you want to do going forward? That's a question that's probably never posed to a man, even coming back from paternity leave. Mm. And it demonstrates a mindset that I think needs to dramatically change. And I don't think Japan is probably not a leader when it comes to paternity leave and so on. But I think if we're entirely honest, I think there's many parts in the world that are struggling with this. From my perspective, I think at the moment, the burden of making family life and work life work in combination almost always falls onto the woman in the relationship. And I think that's where I think we need to do more, also just to encourage fathers to take leave, to allow women who have careers to go back and do exactly as the male colleagues would do. From my perspective, and maybe I'm not a good example because I'm the wrong generation for this in some ways, but the male population within law firms actually has a role to play, and the male partners and the male associates should be as much role models for women to look at as other women are.
Really important. I know one of our previous guests who wasn't from your firm, but she mentioned it was only until, she didn't know, but only until her visit to the US, and she saw that US partners and associates were taking paternity leave, that the penny dropped, that was actually possible. And she's now doing a lot of different work amongst that. It's sort of brought her back into Japan to do a little bit of a change there, and that was Naomi Koshi. But it's really interesting that you're saying that it's the male partners and associates also who need to be driving some of that change and taking the leave. So is that what you're encouraging then, is that the males in the firm are taking the leave, and this is across offices, not just Japan, taking paternity leave, and then others are seeing that role modeled in the firm.
I think that's where I'd like to get to. I would be lying if I said we're quite there. I think these changes take time, but I think that's where we need to get to in Japan and more generally. I was very encouraged also. I'm sitting on the on our partnership selection committee that assesses partnership cases every year. It was very refreshing to see. I mean, as Xue would have described also, it was important for her and it will be important for other female lawyers, is that you can take the maternity leave, and Xue is now on her second one, and it's not viewed in any way as something extraordinary or that is a disadvantage or so on. It's just a natural part of life and people progress nonetheless. And it was, for me, it was very refreshing also in this year's process to have a male candidate in another office who was in many ways sort of probably the primary carer for two young twin children, whilst his wife, also a lawyer, was pursuing an equally high flying and or high caliber legal career. And that was not in any way a stumbling block for his path to partnership. So I think a big part of this is actually also to persuade male lawyers that you can do this and it's not going to be held against you.
Yeah, I think one thing over the pandemic was that some of the results that we had from sort of informal surveys of males was that they were really enjoying being home and looking after their children and being surrounded by their children and wondering how they could, you know, put that into their work practice when they went back to the office, shall we say. So I think there's a lot in there and more to be delved into. And perhaps at some time it'd be really wonderful to speak with that lawyer of yours as well, if he ever does get to a place where we can talk to him. That's really amazing. Anything else here then, Matthias, on this diversity and hiring aspects that we've been talking about so far?
I think maybe two points. One is, and this is probably still on the diversity aspect that deals with gender. I think where I started was that policies are important, but actually I think it's the practicalities to get things right. And I think some of the things that we have introduced, one, I think you're probably aware of, we have a nanny service, an emergency nanny service, for instance, that is available. We also have, and I think that's working quite well, we have a two-way maternity coaching process. Interestingly, we haven't got that for paternity at the moment, I think. The idea there being is actually that women who go on maternity and the partners that they're working with or the team that they're working with actually going through a joint coaching process so that they find the solutions together, which I think has worked very well and has probably been an eye-opener more for the, in this case, for the male colleagues who were being coached than the women also. But I think it's been a great sort of cooperative process to try and work out how to do things in practice, because the policies are good, but it needs to work in practice. And it's often the small things that are not in the policies that make life difficult or easy.
Yes, I think Hitomi and Shirei both talked about that and how they were quite fascinated that the coach can open their eyes to various things, but also just the coach was also surprised at things that, you know, they were dealing with that they weren't aware of. So this is actually available for both males and females in the coaching program, taking paternity or maternity leave. But you're just saying maybe paternity has still got to be developed a little bit there.
I think paternity has got a longer way to go in all respects.
So when it's the coaching of the male person in the program, who is that? Is that the person who is left in the office who needs to cope with the person who's gone on leave? Or where's that coming
from? It's a little bit of that. And also in the case of an associate, for instance, it's also to make sure that we all have full of good intentions. But I think it's also become obvious over years that there are ways of thinking and maybe sort of tendencies that we all have grown up with that need to be reflected on and changed. So it would often be the partner who the female lawyer would report into, for instance, just to try and sit together and work through how this actually really works, and also to make sure that everyone's mindset is set towards just finding the practical solutions to make all this work in the best way.
So you mentioned you had two things. Is that the practicalities of the gender aspect to get things right, and then the couple of examples you were giving there with the emergency nanny service and the maternity?
I think the other one was more around that for me, obviously the gender balance is an extremely important one. And we spend a huge amount of effort trying to do this all the way through people's career. And in the partnership selection process now, we have, as you might know, we have ambitious targets, which I don't think we're quite hitting yet. I don't think any law firm really is, but it's important work. There's other aspects, both on the D and the E. And I think for me, social mobility, for instance, and just wider diversity is equally important. And there's a lot of work to be done. Overall, I think it's just a general reset of how people think. And I think that's been a big focus for us. I've been working, as you mentioned at the outset, I've been working in Asia for many, many years. And one of the bugbears I had originally is that a lot of our career progression processes, including the final partnership selection, interview process and test processes, were all designed by white Anglo-Saxon males for other white Anglo-Saxon males. And in Asia, and I think Japan falls into this category, you are dealing with different, very, very different cultural realities in the sense that as part of Asian culture, there is a lot more, I think, differential behavior amongst lawyers towards people they perceive to be more senior. Just the fact that they may be, and forgive me for saying that I'm German, we're sort of very direct, but they may be less loud and boastful than some of their white male colleagues from other jurisdictions might be. And those sort of characteristics don't necessarily always fit well into the processes that were designed for career progression that we started off with a few decades ago. So I've spent a lot of time over the years trying to adjust the understanding, both in recruitment and career progression, that when you put yourself into a position of a lawyer operating in Japan, you have the expectation that person operates perfectly fluent in English, can do all the things that an English or American lawyer would do. But then you have the parallel expectation that the person can also do this in Japanese equally well and adapt to Japanese cultural settings and behavioral norms. So in fact, you're doubling the task, you're raising the bar considerably higher. And I think getting that recognition built into processes has taken some time, but we've come a long way on that.
Oh, I see. So you are recognizing that there is that double bar to attain because it's both languages and different cultures. And so you're recognizing that is what you're saying.
That is very much recognized these days. Yes.
Right. Okay. I remember the day when I joined Japan when I came here for my first legal role, and it was considered then that Japanese was just a nice to have. And my Japanese was pretty good back then, but it was still not really recognized that that's great. That's lovely that you've got that. But yeah, we don't really need that. We need your legal skills. But now I would say, and perhaps you've got the same thing over the last 10, 15 years, that's really swapped. And we do really expect or like to have somebody who might be a lawyer and also be able to converse in Japanese. Maybe they don't have legal framed Japanese, but being able to converse in a business way with the clients and understand the underlying culture there. Would that be true?
I think so. I think that's where the market is moving. I don't think it's necessarily an absolute must, and there's roles for dinosaurs like me as well to play going forward. But I think it certainly helps. And I think that's my impression, not just here, also I think across Northeast Asia, that's where markets are moving.
Well, tell us more about the markets and the future of law. How are you seeing in your crystal ball gazing what might be the trends in Tokyo and around the globe, if I can take it that far? But I know you've got your hydrogen practice, but what else are you seeing coming through here with new energy or new areas of work that might be quite useful for lawyers to be thinking about as they move forward up the ranks?
I think the market going forward is going to be quite an interesting one. I think we're coming out of, or hopefully coming out of, 2 years of COVID slumber. And I think Asia, Northeast Asia, and I think Japan in particular also has, I think, maybe in some ways on the business side, been suffering more than other parts of the world from this. I think companies' activities have been slow because people have not been able to travel. So the problem is, of course, now as we're coming out of that slumber with lots of energy, we're facing almost sort of untold uncertainties. We have an unspeakable war in Ukraine. There's probably, or at least there is, a specter of global recession lurking ahead of us. So it's very difficult to say where the market is going to move. But from my perspective, that's actually, whilst these uncertainties are certainly uncomfortable, and they often have unfortunate results for many people, they also tend to create a need for lawyers who are flexible, who can adapt to new circumstances, and who have a platform that they can offer to clients to resolve all the uncertainties and try and find solutions. So uncertainty is not necessarily a bad thing for lawyers. I am reasonably optimistic, in, at least for our operation, and I think probably other law firms as well, that there will be plenty of things to do, but I think the world will look different as we go forward. And that's the energy transition. That's the way legal tech has made progress over the last few years, and that in-house departments of clients have been adopting very different ways of working. And our ways of working have changed coming out of COVID. There were obviously challenges, but there are also lots of good things. I think flexible working and remote communications are far more normal now than they were 2 years ago. So I think those for the market going forward, I think that the winners will be those who can adapt and can pick the best of everything that's there, but also be very flexible and be there listening to clients' needs, and are in a position to respond to those.
What does that platform mean? A platform to offer clients to solve problems. How do people go about doing that? What's your advice?
On a personal level, I think it's just building connections, really. And I think we're all, after 2 years of lockdown in some form or other, I think we're all hungry for personal contact, and that's clients, that's everyone. So advice for lawyers would be now just go out and meet people, listen to their stories. There's a lot to tell. But I think platform, when I referred to platform, I think that was partly also just to the fact saying, our clients' problems these days are rarely local. I think there are global problems that need to be tackled. And I think in terms of platform firms like us, we have 40 offices around the world, and we have an extremely diverse team to support clients. I think firms like us are actually quite well placed, because people need consistent advice. If you have big multinational Japanese companies, they will need advice in many different jurisdictions, and they need it coordinated, and they need to have it well thought through. And they're looking for people who are not just lawyers, but who are actually trusted advisors and who they can share strategic considerations with. So I think firms who can bring all of these things to the equation and have a pool of enthusiastic lawyers, I think there is a lot of opportunity going forward.
Any general advice there too that you would suggest to people who are starting out their careers, or perhaps a midway and a little bit floundering as to, you know, I'm doing corporate law, I'm doing M&A, but I want to do something else? Any advice you might provide to how to go about thinking differently about the years that they have ahead of them?
I think talk to clients, talk to the people you're working with, be open-minded and flexible. I think that would be my advice, because the world is changing rapidly. So what seemed like a good career path may not necessarily be the most promising thing going forward. Build up skills and expertise on the areas that will be on people's minds. So energy transition is one, legal tech may be another. I think these days, probably people expect lawyers to be much more than just lawyers and to know more about the things that are on clients' minds. I think there's a general piece of advice probably for any lawyer. We're trained to talk and give advice. I think what lawyers could get much better at, and I see that everywhere, is probably just a simple ability to listen and to reflect on what people are telling you.
It's a great thing. I was at an event last night where that was exactly brought up, is that lawyers need to learn how to actually stop and listen and not be thinking about their next question or what they want to say themselves, but be listening to what they're hearing from their clients and people around them. So I think
it's difficult.
It is difficult, isn't it? Because you do know that you have to get through a certain amount of questions or cover everything before, you know, you close off a call or a Zoom call or something. But listening is so vital. I really think that's an important piece of advice, and to be actively listening. Anything else there that you would say as advice that would be really, really important for people to keep in mind? And maybe you could draw on perhaps what is the best piece of advice that you've received yourself, Matthias, in your life, and perhaps the worst?
I would say the very important aspect going forward is we've all been through a few very, very challenging years, both business-wise and personally. But I think personally, I don't know anyone who hasn't had to fight a whole range of new challenges over the last 2 years. It's been exhausting. My key advice going forward is work is very important and we're all looking forward to work on big and exciting transactions, but life is bigger than that. Find your balance. It's a big focus for us around not just mental health is a sort of the gnome that this goes with, but it's everything from working practices to what do you do outside the office? How do you maintain a proper division between private life and office life when in fact you're online 24/7 at home? So I think it's really important both for individual lawyers, but also for firms to try and make sure that we get a real balance and that the fun bit of life doesn't get lost. I think working hard is great, but I think it's got to be fun as well.
Yeah, and working hard at your fun, right? Working hard exactly. on fun. I love
so
that.
So your question for the worst and best advice, I think the worst advice I ever got was in my younger years when people were telling me, don't waste time. You need to have a clear vision of your career and everything you do needs to fit into that vision. I think very few people in their young years have that or could possibly even have that. And you just feel trapped afterwards. That goes hand in hand with the best advice, which was from my old granny who was in her 80s at the time, which was really just go and follow your instincts. If you make a mistake, you learn from your mistakes.
Oh, I love your granny. So true. I mean, I had no idea. 5-year plan, 10-year plan, 1-year plan was probably, even that was something I couldn't accomplish. It just doesn't happen, does it? This vision of what you are. And if you look back and think about careers, or if I look back at mine, I don't see it that I could ever have had that as a vision. There's no way. But I love your granny. Take it with your instincts. That's so amazing. Oh, dear. Okay. Well, we are getting to the close, Matthias, as we are getting very, very towards the end. I did want to ask you what you're actually thinking about personally for 2022. And it sounds like to me that you are also thinking about this mental health, maintaining that division, having fun, ramping that up in your life, as well as being focused on your work. But in particular, what would you be thinking about for 2022, the remainder? And maybe there's some inspiration to share with lawyers as they plan out their rest of the year.
It goes back to saying, I think we have to be role models, but there's also a very selfish aspect to it. I want to reconnect with all my friends around the world. I want to properly reconnect with all of my clients. I want to talk with them about business, but also about their personal experiences. One of the things that I think for me is very important, as you know, sort of I'm heading up our hydrogen interest group and the whole energy transition. I think it's important to keep promoting this to help clients and also just a general understanding to develop further in terms of thinking and how things can be implemented. So I think conferences, clients, thought leadership pieces, all of these are really, really important. But I must also say I'm absolutely determined for the rest of the year to actually have a lot of fun, to drink my wine when appropriate. I will find another whiskey bar. Yes, we don't talk about the chocolate. I think that's a slippery slope.
There is a cool whiskey bar in Omotesando. It's built like a library. Have you been there?
Probably not. It sounds like we really should compare notes on some of these places. Yes.
It's like a library and all the bottles are laid out like a library. It's really amazing. I'll give you the information later and anyone else who would like that. But is there anything then that your firm is doing for the rest of the year that you like to share with the legal community so that they might be involved?
I think we are continuing, I think, especially in terms of client engagement. I think you will see us in a lot of conferences and similar initiatives going forward. I also hope that obviously over the last few years, the LAN galas and things like that have suffered and were online. So I hope that these sort of activities will come back to life as real people events going forward. But I think we also have internally as a firm, I think we've got a lot of work to do. We've just made up 39 new partners, including our own Taro Nakashima here in Tokyo. We had a good percentage, a better percentage than before of female talent, but there's more to do. But I'm really encouraged. We've also made up 57 councils and the ratio looks much better. It's over 50% of those are women. And as you know, sort of we have some leading female talent here in Tokyo. So I think for me, one of the big focuses is actually to bring that talent through to partnership over the next 12 to 18 months.
Whoa. Well, we heard it here first. That is amazing. What great statistics there that are really, really encouraging. Thank you so much. Is there anything else then, Matthias, that we didn't cover today that you'd like to mention or anything we didn't talk about that you would like to reemphasize?
No, I think that was a pretty good summary, I think, of where we are in life at the moment. As I said, it would be fascinating, maybe, probably not on a podcast, but just to compare notes again in a few months to see how things are actually developing, because I personally believe these are unprecedented times in many ways. At least in my generation, the world has never gone through a level of change as fundamental as what we're seeing at the moment. So I'm really quite excited, unsettled, but also excited by what's going to come.
Love it. Thank you so much. That's wonderful. Well, thank you, Matthias. We have come to the end of this very special episode with you. I really thank you for giving your time today.
No, thank you very much. And as I said, I feel very, very honored to be included, even though I don't quite fit the characteristics of your normal podcast partners. But no, it's been absolutely delightful. Been great. And thank you very much.
Thank you. And you weren't sneaking any chocolate while we were recording, were you?
You may well think so. I couldn't possibly comment.
All right. Well, I mean, you have indeed shared with us some really inspirational insights to the market here. You know, the importance of DEI, making your workplace truly one that embraces all those stages of people's lives as they move through their careers, and telling us that it's about time we all had fun and looked after ourselves. And I really think that's very important messages for everyone to hear. Thank you so much for sharing all of those nuggets of advice, your granny's advice. Oh, I'm still thinking about it. I wish I could have met her. And so listeners too, who are listening into the podcast, please do connect with Matthias. And how do they do that?
I obviously can be contacted by email, but I actually find LinkedIn also quite helpful. I'm quite active on LinkedIn, and I can probably be most easily contacted through that.
Brilliant. Well, we'll put that in the show notes and make sure that when we send everything out, we've got you well tagged there so that people can reach you. And so again, listeners, please do like this episode, subscribe to Lawyer On Air. And also, if you have a chance, do drop us a short review, as that really helps Lawyer On Air be seen and heard by more people. You can also actually drop on over to my webpage and leave me a voicemail. I really do love hearing people tell me in their own words what they thought about the guests. Do go ahead, share this episode with another legal eagle in your community and someone who might enjoy listening to it who may not be a lawyer. Thanks very much, everyone. We'll see you again soon. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now. Thank you so much for listening today to this episode of Lawyer On Air. I really hope that you were inspired by the story you heard and that you discovered something new about women in the law. It's my passion to share my stories of amazing legal ladies, so please subscribe to the show so that you don't miss future episodes. And if you can think of even just one person to share this episode with, that would make my day. I would love to connect with you, so jump on over to LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, or Insta, where you can find me. The links are in the show notes below. Well, that's all from me today, and I look forward to seeing you right here on the next episode of Lawyer On Air. Cheers, kanpai, and bye for now.